Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. This is the Fretboard Journal's 74th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is an unusual podcast for us in that it's a twofer interview. You get two interviews with acclaimed artists, not just one. First up, we're going to be talking to Noam Pikilny, the incredible banjo player from the Punch Brothers. No stranger to the Fretboard Journal or our website, and hopefully no stranger to you guys. And then we're going to be talking to Stuart Duncan, the incredible fiddle player extraordinaire, who has been graced many a fine Nashville session. He's also just an incredible live act. And why are we talking to these two guys together on this one podcast? Because they're about to go on the road together. Stuart was on Noam's last two solo records, and the two of them are going to try to do the banjo fiddle thing on the road, just the two of them, unaccompanied by anyone else. And I thought that was a really cool concept. They're going to be going on the road in mid-May 2014, so check Noam's website for the exact tour dates. But I thought that was a cool concept. I wanted to hear how each of them are approaching these gigs and get a little bit more background on them. Noam is no longer playing the banjo we last talked to him about, so that was a cool revelation. And Stuart Duncan, we don't normally get to talk to fiddle players, but it was a lot of fun talking to him and hearing a bit about his background and his instrument and a lot more. So that's up in just a couple of minutes. Ry Cooter is on the cover of the new Fretboard Journal 32, a very rare, hard-to-get interview, and I'm lucky to say I was the guy who got to do it. 26 pages long, I believe. A lot of never-before-seen photographs of his gear. A lot of stories that I had never read anywhere else. So by all means, come to fretboardjournal.com and subscribe to that if you haven't yet, and we'll make sure you get it. We also have the single issue you can buy, and you can also go to finer guitar stores everywhere and try to track that down. But we encourage you to directly order from us as a reader-supported magazine. And lastly, if you're not into podcasts, but you're into these two guys, Noam and Stuart, we're going to be transcribing both of these interviews and cleaning them up a little bit and posting them on our website for posterity. So you can read them that way, giving you guys some choices. Without further ado, here is first Noam Pikilny, and then a little bit further into it, we're going to be talking to Stuart Duncan, both via the phone. Thanks so much. You and Stuart Duncan are about to go out on the road for May and June, and I know he played on your amazing Kenny Baker record, but I'm curious, when did you guys first meet?
Actually, I have vivid memories of meeting Stuart as a 10-year-old. I think I was maybe 10 or 11. And I met him at the Old Town School of Folk Music when the Nashville Bluegrass Band was playing there. And that was the first time I ever saw him play live. And, you know, I met him briefly. I'm sure he doesn't remember that. But I got to take a lesson with Alan O'Brien, the banjo player from Nashville Bluegrass Band, and so that was the first time we actually met. But as far as actually meeting and playing music, it was probably within the context of Telluride or something that we, you know, both ended up on stage somewhere. But the first time that we really got to play together was when I made that record Beat the Devil in Carrier Rail, and so that was, I don't know, 4.5 years ago, and that was the first instance, and it was pretty momentous to get to record with him. And I remember the situation at the time just seemed like an absolute coup, because it was Gabe, which were producing that record, and you know, Gabe kind of grew up idolizing Stuart Duncan. It was his fiddle hero, and so this is Gabe's first job as a producer, you know, first opportunity to produce, and there he was getting to produce Stuart Duncan. And so it was pretty special.
That's amazing. So what kind of material are you guys going to be doing when you're on the road?
Well, since we have made these two records together, you know, my records that he's played on, we have all the material off of Beat the Devil and Carrier Rail, and then everything off of the Kenny Baker record in common. not everything from those records is really well suited for just the duo format. And so that's giving us an opportunity to round out the set with other material, some of it being new material that I'm working on, and then just kind of classic either bluegrass or American songbook material that we've always been looking for opportunities to work up. And people may not be aware of the fact that Stewart is really a bona fide, like, legit great singer. When you're so good at one thing, like he is at the fiddle, it's hard to really pay attention to anything else. But he's a great singer. I've always enjoyed hearing him sing. And so Stewart's singing a bunch of songs, and I'm even joining in on harmony on some of the material. And he's getting to kind of revisit several of the kind of country songs that he used to play in bars back when he was, a teenager. And so we sat down last week in Nashville and made a list of our favorite material and started brainstorming things that would work in this format. And it's something very exciting for me to get to kind of connect with him in such an intimate kind of context musically. And it really raises the stakes for me as far as how I'm staying busy on stage. The roles of supporting the other musician become so much more crucial when you're the other guy on stage. You're the only other guy on stage.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because usually, what little banjo fiddle duos happen. there's kind of the old-timey approach, or the sort of Ralph Stanley, where the banjo player kind of sits back a little bit and lets the fiddle player do his thing. What is yours just kind of like pure collaboration, pure duo, and see what happens?
Well, I think there are several different approaches. We definitely are showcasing kind of the classic fiddle banjo duet style, which typically, when you hear Earl Scruggs doing that with Benny Martin or any of the other fiddlers, Paul Warren, usually the banjo is kind of playing more of a backup part, the rowing backup part, and the fiddle playing the melody. And every now and then the banjo will join in. We're doing kind of a modified version of that. Like when we first recorded that song, Piney Woods, Stewart takes the lead role and I am playing backup in the kind of fiddle banjo tradition, similar to Earl Scruggs. But one of the things I like doing and did a whole lot of on the Kenny Baker record was learning the fiddle melodies note for note exactly as the fiddle player played it and in the same register. And so one way that we do that that's different is the sound of the banjo and the fiddle playing the melodies in unison together is a little bit of a departure from the classic fiddle banjo approach of that, whereas the banjo might come in and play the melody in the kind of Scruggs style. And I really enjoy doing that, but also getting into the nitty gritty of the fiddle melody and figuring out a way to play it exactly like a fiddle player using melodic picking techniques and also single string techniques. So that's one way that's different. But as far as departing from that formula for other material, we're having to rely on different approaches. John Hartford was one of my favorite banjo players as far as the way he could back up a singer or a fiddle player in the absence of a bass or a guitar. And he had a very clever and bouncy way of playing alternating bass lines on the banjo and emphasizing the parts that a guitar or a bass would typically do. And so that's been part of the inspiration on this. And then one thing to me that is really special about this that probably couldn't happen outside of the duo format is that there are some very subtle sounds that come out of the banjo and the fiddle that are there that you typically get covered up in a band context. And so the banjo is thought of as a fairly staccato instrument, where we don't have that much sustain. I set up my instruments and have gravitated towards instruments that are a little bit warmer and have some sustain, because I do like playing slower music. I need that for playing non-bluegrass music. And that's there on the instrument, but you wouldn't necessarily hear it as far as slow sustain backup, similar to like how a piano player might accompany a song. You wouldn't really ever hear that speaking on a banjo in a full band situation. It would be getting covered up by the other low mids of a guitar. And so on some of the vocal music or some of the waltzes that we're doing, I get to play the banjo the way I would do it, you know, in a room with either playing solo or, you know, in this duo format. I don't have to compete with another instrument in my register sonically. And so that allows you to kind of play the backup parts in ways that typically would never kind of be effective. They would never come through. And I think the same thing is true on the fiddle, as far as a fiddle chop is a really cool sound. And you see fiddle players putting their instrument down like at their waist and kind of chopping on it during a show. Either it's, you know, they're just taking a break from playing, or maybe they're singing, but that rarely gets heard, and that's a really cool texture. And so I think because of the nature of this being such a pared down situation, people will get a glimpse at some of the real subtleties of these instruments, some of the ways that these instruments can be played, and some of the ways that they work if you remove other things from the mix.
It's really cool. And instrument wise, are you playing the banjo you always play, or are you playing kind of a more subtle banjo for this tour? Or?
Well, I actually, within the last year, almost exactly a year ago, traded main axes, which was something I never thought I would do, and maybe even said in the Fretboard Journal I would never find another instrument behind my top tension. But I never say never, because I ended up getting a 1930 Gibson Flathead Granada about a year ago in May of 2013. That was a plectrum conversion, originally a plectrum. And I've been playing that for most of the last year. And so that's going to be my main axe for this show. But I'm also carrying a Daring John Hartford model, which is tuned to open E-flat. It has much thicker strings I have for some of the songs. I really enjoyed playing that instrument. I find myself using it all the time, the low-tuned Hartford banjo. It has this really cool combination of brightness, but richness because of the register and the wound strings. And so it's more staccato than sounding than how I set up my normal standard tuned five strings, but because of the register and the string gauges, there's this richness to it, and so I love that juxtaposition. So those are my two instruments for this tour. Stuart's going to play some clawhammer banjo, and I'm sure he'll have his main fiddle out that he's had for years, and so. That's the plan, instrument-wise.
Did you keep the top tension, or did it have to go in the trade?
It had to go. That was one of the saddest things, but it didn't go very far, and it's in a very good home. So I've had the chance to play it a few times since, and I love that thing, but I'm more in love with the Granada right now.
And your back probably appreciates it.
Exactly. Yeah. My future chiropractor is thanking me now, but not my financial advisor. That's what's happening. And due to the intimate nature of this, I think we'll be able to pull it off with just one microphone, one condenser mic on stage, which to me is is just a joy and something I don't really get to do that much of anymore. As Punch Brothers has expanded our audience, we've had to compete with the volume considerations of festivals or larger rooms. And so Punch Brothers has become fully plugged in. And I think we do it well as far as being able to preserve some of the acoustic nature of the instrument, but it's still never the same as just playing through a condenser mic. And I just expect for us to set up fairly close to each other on stage and play into one mic.
Sounds amazing. Are you going to be recording it?
I'm hoping to, at least be recording some of the live shows, but there's nothing in the works yet as far as making a record. I mean, it would be an obvious choice since we've been working up an entire show, and by the end of the summer we'll have, you know, maybe 15 shows under our belt. And so I would absolutely love to just go into the studio and sit down and play stuff down.
Cool. Well, Noam, thank you so much as always, and look forward to hearing about how the tour goes.
Great. Thanks for your interest as always.
So. Of course. That's what we're here for.
Okay.
Right.
We'll see you guys soon.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.
So that was Noam Pikilny, always a great guy to talk to, and here is Stuart Duncan.
So Stuart Duncan, thank you so much for talking to us. I just talked to Noam, and we've never spoken because the Fretboard Journal doesn't do a lot in the world of fiddles, although I know you do more than just play the fiddle. But can you tell me a little bit about, I mean, you are such an in-demand session guy. You look at the All Music Guide credits. I see everything from like Garth Brooks to Johnny Mathis to the stuff with Yo-Yo Ma to traditional stuff. How do you divide your week up, I guess I'm curious about?
Every year is different. 10 years ago, it was difficult to find the time on Fridays and Mondays, you know, to get to a weekend gig with a Nashville bluegrass band and get back to do any kind of country sessions that might be, you know, starting on Monday. Now I'm doing so much less country music sessions that I have like weekdays open now and more road work. So I'm out of town for like longer periods of time, but I'm also missing less as far as session, you know, as far as country music sessions go. So if every year is different, I seem to be doing more non-country things in the past 3 years, which is kind of how I started, playing more, you know, swing music, old-time music, bluegrass music.
Is that just the changing tastes of country music, that they're employing fewer and fewer fiddle players, or?
The budget has a big part of it. The internet has created this notion that music is now free, which is actually very true now. When you can just as easily get a song that you're looking for on Spotify as you can on iTunes, then whoever wrote the song and whoever played on it makes absolutely nothing off of it. So, I mean, and everybody's just kind of given up on that. I mean, 10 years ago, they were still, fighting that battle. And I think it's actually over now. And so there's that. And then there's also the fact that, much like what happened in the late 70s and early 80s, mostly late 70s, the prevailing wind of record production went to the safety. You know, they want to play it safe and only include electric guitars and keyboard and drums and bass and not any kind of instruments that point to it being a traditional sound, because that's just not selling records now, that kind of mentality. And, you know, when the wind blows that way, everybody jumps on that wagon, and it takes another 5 or 6 or 10 years for it to turn around until they'll use pedal steels and fiddles again.
What?
I'll hang around till then.
Yeah. At least you have a lot of different projects you can fall back on. Have there been any recent mainstream music sessions that have kind of impressed you in terms of you were able to kind of let loose and do what you're great at?
You know, I occasionally get a mainstream thing that'll come around, and whoever's producing will say, just be yourself, and we'll, you know, because we don't want to say too much or guide you in any certain way, because they know that that I'm the kind of player that does better when you leave me alone, you know. And one of those producers is Nathan Chapman, who's been producing Lady Antebellum, and he also produced Taylor Swift, I believe, and a few others. And I did something with him recently where he absolutely did that, and other producers, Paul Worley, he actually used to produce the band Perry, and then other people have done that. But there's been a couple of band Perry songs that have come out that have had solos from me that were somewhat unexpected in the country arena. I guess because the music's changed enough that something a little edgier is expected. You know, it wasn't. And in fact, one of them has even plugged in fiddle, like with Overdrive, which was. I mean, I've been doing that on the road with some people, like the Robert Plant, Alison Krauss tour I was on. You know, I used a lot of Overdrive on that because we were rocking out. But you know, I don't think I've ever used it on a mainstream country record until recently.
Interesting. And going back a bit, you know, I just interviewed our most recent Fretboard Journal has Ry Cooder on the cover, and he's talking about, you know, growing up in L.A. and Santa Monica and the country and the bluegrass and the old time scene that was happening there. And that's kind of what you grew up in as well, right?
Yeah.
What, I mean, were you at the Ash Grove as a kid? Were you doing all that stuff? Were you kind of in a different scene? Can you kind of tell me about how you got to this point?
I was, I think probably, in, you know, the heyday of the Ash Grove predates me a little bit, although I was there, as a child in the late 70s, and saw some folks come through there. But, I was living in San Diego County back then until I was like 14. So the folk club that I had experience with was one of those in-between dates that you never, you know, that artists, if they were coming through, would put it in as an in-between, between bigger venues like the Ash Grove or the Ice House in Pasadena, which was even more of a hang for me. They had more bluegrass at the Ice House than they did other places. But my dad ran the sound at a folk club in Escondido, California, called In the Alley. And so when I was like 6 and 7 years old, I would go with him down there to the club and help him set up the mic cables and stuff. And then I would hear the first set and then fall asleep by the time the second set came around. And but that was my introduction into hearing some fiddle players come through. And in fact, back in, and that would have been like 1971 and 72, the Dillards came through with and had Byron Burline sitting in with them. They had done a record back in the 60s together, but, you know, he wasn't in the band, but he was sitting in with them. And so I got to hear Byron, and then like the next week I got to hear Vassar Clements with the Earl Scruggs Review. And those two things were the catalyst to say, you know, I need to play the fiddle.
Yeah. And what? How old were you?
I was 7.
Wow.
Saw those. And so, yeah, that's the year I started.
Wow. And your dad doing the sound, obviously there was a lot of music in your house and this kind of music in the house, right?
Not so much bluegrass, but old time and folk music and Irish and Scottish music and Dixieland were what was in my house growing up. And my dad had a long neck banjo, much like Pete Seeger had. Sort of thing.
Yeah. So I just talked to Noam a fair amount about the gear he's going to be using on tour with you. What can you tell us a bit about your fiddle, your main fiddle that you're going to be taking out on the road?
You know, for the first time in a long time, I've got another a second fiddle that I'm fairly proud of. So I'm not so sure of which one I'll be spending most time on, but the one that I've played most of my life since I was 12 years old is an old German fiddle that I bought from Kenny Baker, who was Bill Monroe's fiddler at the time. And it's been my go-to fiddle for everything in the studio and live. You know, anything not plugged in, because I don't keep a pickup on it.
Yeah.
But I have one now with a pickup on it that I've been traveling with Diana Krall with this other fiddle that I just got together that I'm really, really happy with. So I may be using them both. They're both German.
And is that the fiddle that you were talking about you'd play electric with Robert Plant?
Well, actually the same pickup system, different fiddle.
Okay. And I guess there's a bond right there, as you know, you were on Gnome's Kenny Baker record and you bought that fiddle from Kenny Baker.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, how did that transaction go down with Kenny?
Interestingly enough, my dad had made me a violin for my 11th birthday. And I've been playing that about 6 months. And so we were at Bean Blossom, Indiana, the Bill Monroe's festival up there, Brown County. And I think I had just turned 12 at the time. And so Kenny was, you know, real nice to me and encouraged any young players that were trying to play his tunes. You know, he was very nice to me and said, well, let me show you some of these fiddles I got, you know. So I went ahead and played every fiddle he had at the table. And George Chestnut were selling them together. And I came across this fiddle that just sounded better than all the rest to me. And my mom and dad both grudgingly agreed that it sounded better than the one my dad had made me, too. And so, you know, I kind of look at my dad like, well, that's really good. And, you know, how much is it? And I believe Kenny said, you can have that for $260. And so it was like next to nothing compared to what I would have expected. And so my mom just like said, I think you should have that. And so she just got her checkbook out and bought it from him right then.
Wow.
Still have the check.
Wow.
And my dad had to admit that it's a better sounding fiddle than any other one. At least I got used to it. I can't play any other fiddle and have it sound the same way.
That's amazing. Is it a well-known or even known maker?
Well, I mean, part of the reason that it was that cheap is because it doesn't have a name in it.
Yeah.
And it had a few cracks in it that had to be fixed. But it has been the best, the best $260 I've ever spent.
Yeah.
My mom's ever spent.
Served you well, that's for sure. So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing with Gnome. I talked to him about, you know, the repertoire and how you're going to be bringing out stuff from both the records you did with him on this little tour you're doing. But he also mentioned that you're quite a great vocalist. Can you tell me how long you've been doing that?
Longer than people know about. I wisely, early in my life, surrounded myself with really good singers. So I didn't really have to worry about it. And during that time, I had been, you know, practicing and trying to get better at it myself because I've always loved to sing. And so just because I have been associating with other people and getting out there and trying to do some more solo things, I decided to, you know, why don't I sing a little bit? There's no one, you know. It's only when I'm surrounding myself with people like Tim O'Brien and Alan O'Brien and other, you know, great singers that I feel like, well, maybe I should let them have it. If they're not in the picture, why not, right?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm just trying to do what I love. That's all.
And what kind of tunes will you be working on for this tour, you think, where you're singing?
A mixture of maybe some things that are more expected from me, like from the bluegrass tradition, and then a couple of things that are more ballad, like one from Merle Haggard and one from Carl Jones, who wrote some for Norman Blake and wrote Last Time on the Road for National Bluegrass Band, stuff like that. And a few others. Noam and I are going to cover the Stanley Brothers a little bit, sing some together. I'm not sure anybody will have seen that coming.
Well, just from talking to you guys, you have two very different voices, but I'm very excited to hear that. You're also a phenomenal clawhammer banjo player. Are you going to be what banjo do you take out on the road for something like that?
I have an old Vega, like a Vegaphone. It would have been made in the 20s. It has a skin head on it. And I really like that. I also have a Lion and Healy fretless that I love with nylon strings. One of the points that got brought up in discussing how to be, a multi-instrumentalist on this tour is the fact that we're going to be flying for a couple of legs of this tour. And so I think what's going to happen is that I'm not going to get to take my banjos. I'm going to have to play one of Noam's. He's going to play two banjos, one for other tunings, right? And I'll play either his. He'll switch to the one in an alternate tuning, and I'll play his good banjo. That's the way I'm hoping that'll go, because then I get to play a pre-war Gibson, but
a little more volume than the ones you have,
So I'll be claw hammering on his bluegrass banjo, which is not maybe the most comfortable thing. But, it'll be an imitation of the real thing.
Yeah, no, I love it. And how do you, have you guys kind of, it sounds like you guys have kind of worked out how this is all going to go down. The banjo fiddle duo is not a common thing these days. Have you thought about how you approach it as a fiddler?
Yeah. That's one of the first things we did was to just conceptually talk about it before we ever started to play any tunes together. Because we already knew that we could do that. But to say, okay, what else are we going to do besides the six obvious things that we can do from each of these records, and just the fact that there's a great tradition of fiddle and banjo music, carved out by Paul Warren and Earl Scruggs, mostly, and other people too. So that's where we started was, okay, let's talk about what else can be done before we ever strike a note, and that's what we did. When you're sort of working out a tune in a bluegrass band, sometimes maybe only one or two of the guys have heard the song or are part of writing the song. And so you end up like taking on the role of the mandolin with the fiddle in your hand, like playing a percussive chop, or take on the role of the guitar, even with the fiddle in your hand and strumming chords on it. And instead of just showing somebody how the tune goes and then letting them play it on the guitar, we're actually playing the whole thing that way on the fiddle instead. Letting the instruments take on other roles within the piece. And, the absence of bass and guitar are the most noticeable. But also what we noticed upon that is that it gives the banjo a lot more room for all of its voices to be heard, even the low end, which in a bluegrass band, the low end of the banjo is one of the first things that gets swallowed by everything else that's happening. And, with just the fiddle being above it, you really get to hear all the bass tones that the banjo has too. So it's really, I really like it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, I'm definitely excited, and thank you so much for talking to us.
Absolutely.
All right.